right to Hospital 83. We do have the sponsor here. I'm going to ask Ms. Cunningham if she can refresh the committee's memory on what we did with this and where we're at. For the record.
Thank you. For the record, Suzanne Cunningham, staff to Co-Chairman Meyer. When this bill was first heard, they had opening statements by the sponsor and closed, and they took public testimony and closed public testimony. And now we have a blank CS that we'd like for the committee to consider.
Okay. Mr. Chairman? Go ahead, Director Schultz.
If I remember correctly, the only intention or non-intention of the effective date was really constructive discussion.
Through the chair, yes, Representative Stoltz.
Okay, was there any other changes other than what you just explained?
If you would like to adopt a blank committee substitute before the committee as the working document?
Yes. Can we have a motion to adopt a blank committee substitute?
I'll move.
Okay, your motion then is for version 24LS0372/Y bullet 4705. That is the working document. Any objections? Let's see, none. That's the working document in front of us. Representative Ledoux, are you comfortable with the changes made to your bill?
Yes, I am. We worked with members of your staff and other committee members to try to come up with this, and my understanding is this changes the date for extension until 2008, but it sunsets it in 2006 if the governor hasn't made appointments before that time. And that sounds like a reasonable thing to do. So now it's going to be a matter, assuming we get this as a bill, of convincing the governor to make some appointments.
I agree. How do we do that? This governor and the governor prior to him have not, so we'll have to work on it. It's a good bill. Any other questions?
I just had a quick question.
Sure.
For the record.
Go ahead.
When you add three representatives from local government, is anything in your mind there? I mean, what's your intent there? Why three representatives from local governments?
Because local government is so important to this process. And in one of the other committees that I was in, it was a suggestion that was made, and it sounded like a reasonable suggestion that local governments, they know what they need and what is of concern to them. And so I think that they can really be an asset to this commission.
Okay. Anything else, Representative Mark? Okay, does everybody know the changes that were made to Section 6, Section 7, Section 8? And Representative just mentioned if the governor doesn't appoint people to the commission by July 1, 2006, then it is to conclude its administrative operations by June 30, 2007. Go ahead, Representative
Chairman. I don't want to belabor this bill, but local governments, is that, I assume it's your hope government representatives that have an interest, some history with seismic occurrences?
Yes.
I'm
comfortable with the generic language. I would hope that when the governor makes his appointments, though, that he takes into account things like people's experience and so forth.
And then just to make sure I understand, if the commission is extended to 2008, then another sunset audit will be done to evaluate the progress. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding.
And Ms. Davidson, your understanding? You can just nod your head. All right. Anything else? Representative Foster?
Yes, sir. I'll go ahead and move out HB 83 out of committee. We attach to it some of the individual recommendations.
Any objections? Seeing none. No passes. Thank you, Representative Duke.
Thank you very much.
Also, for the record, Representative Foster has joined us, as well as Representative Holm. And we're going to take just a brief break here while we get the new Hospital 149.
Thank you.
Okay.
Croft has joined us. We're going to take up House Bill 149, but before we do that, Representative Stoltz.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to immediately rescind our action in passing House Bill 149 Finance out of committee previous action.
Any objections? Seeing none, we have House Bill 149 back to the floor. So I'm going to ask Ms. Cunningham to explain where we're at with this bill.
Thank you. When the bill was taken up yesterday before the committee, Amendment 1 was adopted to provide that information that was collected by retailers, by people who purchased sole active ingredients that contained ephedrine, pseudoephedrine, or salts or isomers. That information would be held confidential. In working with the Department of Law and our legal services, the conceptual amendment that was brought forth by Representative Hawker, we encountered a little bit of a problem. The confidentiality was linked to the Public Information Act, AS 4025-100 through 4025-220. In talking with our legal services, we found that it was not necessary to reference the Public Information Act because retailers are not a public entity or a public agency such as state government that would be subjected to this law.
Okay. Very good. So the bill before us has Amendment 1, which has been approved. So at this point in time, I will accept Amendment 2 if there is one.
And Mr. Chairman, to get something debated in front of us, I would move Amendment 2, 24LS0596/N.1 version.
Okay, it's been moved and objected. Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. As discussed earlier, it's amazing when you put two lawyers on the same project and start to disagree with each other. So we had one group of competent counsel suggest the language that for the conceptual amendment that was incorporated in the N version of this bill. We've had other attorneys who have counseled that that was not the best and brightest way to approach this. And I guess we're deferring to the second opinion, and Amendment 2 eliminates the conflict and simply just makes it clear that the information in these laws, and again, this amendment is intended to preserve the privacy and protect the individuals that have to go on record for purchasing Sudafed, no matter who you are, how old you are, or otherwise. But this amendment makes sure that information is confidential and may not be released to anyone except the Department of Public Safety or other law enforcement officers. And again, this whole purpose of this amendment is to make certain that this data is not used inappropriately, whether it be for telemarketing purposes or you know, however else it might be made unreasonably open to public inspection.
Okay, Representative Hawker, now your amendment, page 9, is just line 20, delete all the material, or is that
line 20 to 22 on the end?
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense.
And that cleared up the confusion on lines. We got the proper version.
Right, that's right.
The
okay.
N version is the amended version.
Okay, yeah, then that works. Representative Croft.
Appreciate the thoroughness of this. The log and the information entered into the log is confidential. The retailer may not allow. I understand why the retailer wouldn't be a public agency and therefore not under the Public Information Act. Once it gets into public safety, is there a concern that somebody does a Freedom of Information Act? Because the way it used to read, safety shall have access to the log, great. The log may be used for law enforcement purposes only, so once you get it, law enforcement purposes only. Mm-hmm. And the log in my possession now as a governmental agency, the Department of Public Safety, is not subject to disclosure under. We're sort of doing two changes in this, and it may be all right, I just want to understand it. What happens when it's in the possession of public safety, what's its status there as a public document or not? And in the amendment, we're really not just protecting, but prohibiting the retailers from doing something. The retailer may not allow access to the log or release information contained within the law. And they kept it. It's their record of them selling product to people. And normally they could keep whatever records they want about who buys their products and use them in any way they want, I would think. There's nothing particularly private, unlike a medical transaction where HIPAA and these other things come into play. But I walk in and buy a comb and Sudafed, I don't have much expectation that that's a private transaction.
Mr. Chairman, again, we are standing in place and mandating mm-hmm. in order to acquire a pharmaceutical product that has no other restrictions upon it, only on a pharmaceutical product, mm-hmm. that someone goes in and physically signs a law that includes their government identification and mm-hmm. the number on that identification. Now, that we are mandating that with this bill. Now, as opposed to if that retailer, selling Cheerios, grocery store selling Cheerios, desires to require a log of buying Cheerios, you as a consumer have a choice whether to buy Cheerios at that store that mandates you sign the log or going next door to the store that does not. Here we are not giving that up. That option does not exist to the person. And again, we are in this age of identity theft and associated problems, telemarketing abuse, identity theft, I have grave concerns about putting everything, any records that we are making as to be required to maintain by retailers, and it was discussed previously, some may or may not be particularly sophisticated retailers. I just want to make it very, very clear that all this information that is personal and private to an individual is protected to the greatest degree possible, consistent with giving law enforcement the greatest tools possible to combat the methamphetamine plague.
That's a good answer.
Let's get a sponsor on Christian Harris. You've heard Christian Hawker's mentioned it too. Are you in concurrence with your name?
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, the age that we live in, because I've talked to retail clerks at Fred Meyer's, and when they do those price lookup unit codes on the bottom, and then you use your reward card to get a discount, or you pay with a credit card, they already know a lot more about you than you can manually input into a log. And most of us pay with a credit card at the grocery. And so I appreciate the sensitivity that Representative Hawker brings to this issue, and I concur completely because my privacy is important to me, and maintaining the privacy of the other citizens of Alaska is absolutely critical also. But I don't want to lose sight of the objective here, which is this plague, that sits in many of our communities. So I think what we have to foster here is a balance between maintaining privacy and getting to the root of this issue.
Okay.
Which is not a good answer, but it was a philosophical answer.
Yeah, it's
Mr. Chairman.
By the way, I want to welcome Representative Kelly to the committee. It's been a rock. Okay, Representative Hawker, some sponsor supports your amendment. Any other discussion on Amendment 2?
If I may, sir.
Go ahead.
Representative Croft had put another question on the record, and that regarded the continuing confidentiality if the information is secured by the public, Department of Public Safety or the law enforcement officer. I think this is the case where we've now had a third confident legal mind take a look at this amendment, and not to put words in his mouth, but I believe we've concluded that other statutory protections exist to provide that protection the confidentiality protection should law enforcement avail itself of these records.
Very good. Appreciate that. Appreciate the Attorney Croft looking at this. Let's not show it to any more attorneys. Thank you. Okay. Any objections to Amendment 2? Seeing none, Amendment 2 is adopted. There's an Amendment 3, Representative Croft.
Yeah, I'll move Amendment 3.
Okay, so we're moving objective. Go ahead.
I apologize for the form of this. It's a continuing discussion with the Representative Crawford, who sponsored a version of this bill before. And I mainly want to hear, I guess, the objections, and maybe I'll withdraw it, but we're in a balance between, do they keep the records and then just wait until law enforcement asks, or do they send them in on some sort of regular basis? And there's a burden to what could be very small, unsophisticated operations, or small operations, let's say, who are busy, of having to send information in. But a burden on the law enforcement if you have to go to every single store and ask. Seems to me there ought to be some way for businesses not to have to send this in if it's not really being used, but for law enforcement to say, we are now concerned about meth production in your area. Will you now please send us for some period of time, 3 months, 6 months, the information on who's buying these products? If you made a general reporting requirement, which was part of this, or part of versions of this and other bills, you run the risk of being having overly burdensome. You know, there's a little Sitka mom and pop that they're not using meth in Sitka; they don't need to. But I'm exploring for some mechanism for the police to say, send us this information because now we do think it's relevant. It's a danger in this area, whatever, for some discrete period of time. And wanted to get both the sponsors and law enforcement, if we have it, reaction. How much do they use it? How much would regular help, regular reporting of this help? What mechanism can we craft to solve that?
Okay, I don't think we have anyone with law enforcement here. And I think your amendment says that this would be if the law enforcement agency voluntarily asked for this information. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the sponsor has a comment. Go ahead, Mr. Members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Representative Croft, if you will, and the committee will turn to page 9, line 30, subsection E. We think that this addresses this, and frankly, this was the compromise that we came up with in House Judiciary. And what we're concerned about is, you know, creating a fiscal note for law enforcement to have a room full of logbooks of people that have a cold and or have had a cold.
Which version are we getting? The end version?
The end version.
Oh, yes.
And
I'm sorry.
And it'll be, I think, Ms. Representative Ramos, page 10.
Okay. I'm sorry. We have version U. My apologies.
Thank you very much.
Version, should have version N. Representative Stokes.
I should know this backward forward. It's Kim, an old friend, Ramos knows it. Is it the likely probability that municipalities will become more active in or surveying police department? And that's where the crux of the, that's where the focus of the resources will be from local governments.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, you're exactly right. The approach that we took is that there are certain communities that have a more severe problem than other communities. So for the city of North Pole, for some of the Mat-Su communities, can have an opportunity to have a more acute approach to this, and other communities where it's less of an issue don't necessarily need need to gather all the information into a central depository. And so, as the sponsor, we're going to oppose Amendment 3 in that this would, the way that the language is written, a single law enforcement agency, a local law enforcement agency in the state, could require the whole state to conform to depositing information. And we just don't want to see it be a burden or a large fiscal note, you know, or logbooks that sit in a closet. In a manner of speaking, they're more accessible at the retail service point than they are if they're sitting in Department of Public Safety in a room that, you know, in a supply closet or shipped out to a, you know, to a storage facility. So we feel like that this was adequately addressed in House Judiciary, and really appreciate Representative Crawford's concern about this, because we've had a lot of conversations about it. I've got the utmost respect for his concern, and he and I are really on the same page with this. We just think there's a different way to skin this banana.
Yeah, if I understand, your bill is doing what Amendment 3 is proposing to do, only you're leaving it up. It's kind of a local option. By ordinance, they can ask for this information if they have a need or desire.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what we think. Because there are some communities where crystal meth is just not is prevalent in how many meth labs there are. I mean, we see in Barrow from the other day that they're up there in Barrow, but they don't seem to have the same problem that the Mat-Su Valley does or that the community in North Pole does. And we would prefer to keep government from encroaching as much as possible and yet deal with the significant issue of crystal meth.
Yeah, appreciate all that, and I think the compromise is closer to where I am anyway. Let me just pose this question. So what happens if the city of North Pole, with a significant problem, passes its local ordinance requirement, and neither the Fairbanks North Star Borough nor the city of Fairbanks decides to? Aren't you, I mean, that, and that's what this is trying to approach, or Anchorage decides to, but Wasilla does not. If you don't, if you're trying to deal with that problem in North Pole, and they can simply go half a mile over, and where there's no recording, how is that much of a local option in the way people can go and municipalities bordering right on and get out of it?
Through the chair, Representative Croft, the Department of Public Safety has already testified that they approve of this language the way that it is, but they are not the local law enforcement, the local police departments. And I think that, technically speaking, you're absolutely right, but I think what we're not paying attention to is the common sense dynamic, which is that local law enforcement agencies tend to cooperate, and that this is a common enemy of all communities. And you know, the FPD and the North Pole Police and the state troopers work closely together, and I don't know how much discord there is amongst other communities that share geographic boundaries. You would be able to speak to that better than I would, Representative.
Well, I'll withdraw for now. I think you'll see this concept again probably on the floor, but maybe it can be more refined then. So appreciate you coming back and fixing that and the discussion on this, but I'll withdraw on that.
Okay, the ministry has been withdrawn. Any other amendments, Representative Mark Kelly?
No, just a question. Okay. Just curious, to the chair, how much of this writing it down, the logbook, and the person that makes the purchase knows that it's getting written down, how much of that is achieving the cop car effect, and how much of that is really ever going to be looked at? Not that I'm arguing with it. I'm just wondering, where do we get the bang for the buck? Is it in the cop car effect or in the legibility of the signature?
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, you've hit the nail on the head. This is these premises patrolled by Action Security, and the burglar skipped that house. And the Department of Public Safety has indicated that these are already paranoid people anyway. When they know that they have to show identification and sign for it, they are going to be less likely to purchase the product, and it is a deterrent in many, many ways. And so you're precisely right. It's the cop car, you know, patrolling the neighborhood, and we think that that's one of the best elements of this deterrent strategy. In the same way that we've sat through compliance, we heard Mr. Chairman, we heard your bill on compliance on the alcohol checks, and statistics support that, you know, 80%. There's been an 80% improvement, I believe, Mr. Chairman, if you want to correct me, in underage drinking, and that has become come largely because servers and bartenders now know that there are these compliance checks going on, and so as a result, they've gotten much better at checking for identification. And so it's really the same process that's going on here. So thank you for the question.
Thank you,
Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Seeing that, Representative Costa.
Yes, sir. I'll back and move CSAC
149
put in
that recommendation as amended
with the
attachment
from the
committee. Okay. Any objections?
Seeing
none, the bill moves
out of
committee again.
Thank you again to the committee, and Mr. Chairman, in particular Representative Stoltz. This has been a big issue for our communities. We appreciate it a lot. Thank you.
since the rules chairman is here, I'm glad that you let us rescind this bill and not put the burden on the rules chairman. Thank you for Mr. Rules Chairman.
What do we do here for
that? You want to do his left? I don't think he heard. I just complimented.
Oh, well.
We took care of the city and rules.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate that.
Just remember the Finance Committee.
Mr. Chairman,
we're not ready yet.
Oh, okay. Well, good. I can thank you very much for your kind consideration before we're on the record.
Okay. Enough cute noise here. Okay, next bill before us is House Bill 136, Drunk Driving Program, Representative Roper's bill. And his my constituent, his trustee aide, Heather Noberger.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, it took me 2 years.
You had problems.
I know, I just did.
I never did Noberger.
I think your family has trouble with it.
Okay, anyway, both the sponsor and his aide are here, and so with that, let's have Roper tell us what the deal is about.
Mr. Chairman, it's, I'm Representative Norman Roper from District 27 in Anchorage. It's really a pleasure to be back before the committee. It's been quite a while, and there's no camera here today. So, with me is my counsel and assistant, Heather Nabriga. And so any technical questions? Mr. Chairman, this is a powder puff compared to the last bill you just had under consideration. This does three main things. It speaks to the issue of wellness or therapeutic courts. It does one thing. It requires that the minimum fines set out by the legislature for driving while under the influence shall be collected and imposed by the courts. Now, this is a non-therapeutic court issue. Mr. Chairman, if you recall, several years back, I was the sponsor and author of HB4, one of the toughest drunk driving laws in the country.
I think we all remember that.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, it came to our attention that the Court of Appeals there was a Court of Appeals decision that many jurisdictions, and particularly in the First Judicial District, were not imposing the $1,500 minimum fine for that offense. Therefore, we asked that we rewrite slightly those provisions of the law that mandate the minimum fines. The second point, Mr. Chairman, is that this allows for the therapeutic courts to be used in the felony DUI courts. Mr. Chairman, there was provisions giving some freedom of imposition of sentences and so forth to the district court level to support Judge Wanamaker and the fledgling, at the time, therapeutic court in Anchorage. And what we would like to do, because of the good experience there, is extend these provisions of flexibility to the judges that are administering the felony DUI courts in Anchorage and Bethel. And thirdly, Mr. Chairman, it increases the amount of fines that may be waived for successful therapeutic court graduates from the 50% to 75%, giving them greater carrot or incentives to operate. With that, Mr. Chairman, happy to ask any questions. I know Ms. Cindy Cash of the Mad Mothers was here to testify and asked her whether she would, but there's a support letter from Mad in here. And I believe online is Judge John Wanamaker, who is really the father of the therapeutic courts here in Alaska, that I believe wants to give some testimony. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Representative Roper. We also have Wendy Hamilton.
Oh.
Court here in Juneau. Any questions for the sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Roper. Is there any benefit to saying that you're on the amendment that you have here in the bill, where the person pay at least the minimum fine? They have to pay the minimum fine, but could they pay more than the minimum fine? It's pay the minimum fine. But is there a range where in this statute that allows the court to impose greater than minimum fine if they feel there's, exacerbating circumstances?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, this is Heather Nabriga, staff to Representative Roberg, and I can answer that question for Representative Wyrock. The way it's phrased, they have to serve the minimum sentence and pay the minimum fine. Currently, courts can impose more than the minimums, but often they suspend the additional amount. So let's say a first-time DUI offender might get 33 days in jail with 30 suspended and a $5,000 fine with 3,500 suspended. So, actually, that's bad math. I think that 2,500 suspended. So they are, the courts do go over the minimums, but often suspend portions of that. So this doesn't, I don't believe this inhibits the courts from going over the minimums in their sentencing.
So it would not be good policy to say they had to pay at least the minimum fine?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirich, I don't think that we need to put the words at least in there. I think the way it's written, it coincides with serve the minimum fine and pay the minimum fine, which is previously in our statutes, and I know it's not prohibited judges from imposing more than the minimum sentence. So I believe the way it's written is...
I see. And this has to do with a person that had been previously convicted as well, too. That falls under that rubric. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Weirich, it will apply to all DUI offenders on any level.
So first conviction as well?
Correct.
I just was trying to see if
we can come back to it.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Rookberg, for the bill. I guess I've heard that it's difficult sometimes to get into alcohol treatment because we're full up, and an amendment on that idea, but on Section 3, it makes a lot of sense to me to increase the fines. It makes a lot of sense to me to have some carrot, if you will suspend or forgive a lot of the fine if you complete a program. Should we have some language that recognizes somebody's trying to get in, attempting to get in on the waiting list, and they just can't get in within a year and a half? Should some aspect of that idea be appropriate?
Oh, through the chair, Representative Croft, you may have a germ of an idea there. I would like to hear from Judge Wanamaker if you want to hold a question until you can maybe ask him on that. Because he's hands-on experience. If I sit here and try to talk around something, let him answer that. He knows better than I or both of us.
Fair enough. We'll hold that question. Representative Wanamaker?
Yeah, another question. Representative Roper, you and I had talked before, and there's a bill now in the legislature that will allow expungements of certain convictions upon... if there had been a suspended imposition of sentence, and if an individual had been convicted of drunk driving, because it doesn't allow the court to suspend, says that the court may not suspend imposition of sentence. This is not part of the portion you amended, right? Is it appropriate to look at it in this context where we may consider expunging those convictions in certain instances, certain rare instances, where there's been a suspended imposition of sentence? A first-time person who drives under the influence and then a serious time has lapsed since their conviction, they still have that on their record. If they've led a good life and want that expunged from their record, not having a suspended imposition of sentence wouldn't allow it even under this circumstance. Is there some public policy reason in certain conditions to allow suspended imposition of sentence for a DUI?
Through the chair, my first impression on this question is that I believe the public policy should be to prohibit the SIS to this particular instance, in large part because the way the statutory scheme is drafted, there's substantial time elements going out to 15 to 20 years that you have to look at the past record in order to met out the statutorily mandated sanctions. So I think it may be somewhat troublesome because the statutes fit together in such a manner that there's nexus or connections between the numbers of offenses and what times they occur. Matter of fact, this legislature last year actually pulled one back, because I believed that we'd gone, we didn't have a cutoff point, but that That was like a 20-year period. We moved it to 15 years just to show you how they're all connected. So I'm not sure that would be appropriate without further reflection.
Anything else, Representative Waterman? Okay, seeing no questions, so let's go on a teleconference here to Judge Wanamaker. Judge, you with us today?
Oh, yes, I'm on the telephone here. Can you hear me okay?
Sure, can. Yeah. Just now you might speak a little better, maybe.
Okay.
Okay, now we can hear it.
All right, well, I'm pleased we have the opportunity to speak. I might mention that I retired as a judge on January 31. I sampled retirement for a month in Hawaii, and I started working with the Alaska Center for Therapeutic Justice, which is a division of Partners for Progress, and our main mission is to promote therapeutic courts such as the Wellness Court, and I certainly endorse what Representative Rookberg said about the effectiveness of the Wellness Court model and the benefits. He mentioned the economies of scale in his written comments on the bill when it was introduced, and that would be the case. The their state Wellness Court in the misdemeanor level in Anchorage now, which is in operation, and in Juneau they'll start operation by summer, and also in Ketchikan by summer. So the felony cases could just join into that operations, which are already underway, and be a good economy of scale. So I think there's not, it's recognized there isn't any fiscal impact on this bill, but I'd welcome the chance to respond to any questions.
Okay, we do have a Representative Cross question. Did you hear that?
Oh, I did, and the idea of getting recognition for being on the waiting list through the chair to Representative Croft. All the therapeutic courts have capacity right now. None of them are operating over their design capacity. And there has been a problem in the two House Bill 172 courts, the ones created by the legislature in about 2001. In that the Department of Corrections has effectively pulled out from the case coordinator function, and that has stalled the Bethel Court for a while. They're back to operating now, but still is stalling the, as a couple weeks ago, anyway, I was updated on that, the Anchorage Court. So people have been on a waiting list because the DA won't put people into that court, because there's no case coordinator. The court system is trying to remedy that by making a memorandum of agreement with ASAP and the Department of Health and Social Services to do the case coordinator function, and then they'll be back in operation. But yeah, before I left the bench at the district court level, we do arraignments on felonies, and I've had a couple experiences where people were trying to get out on bail, and I mentioned you should get into the, they're in on felonies, and I mentioned you should get in the felony DUI court, and upon inquiry, there was nobody being allowed in because there was no case coordinator. That's unfortunate, but once that problem is solved, there won't be any problem with capacity.
Go ahead, Mr.
Yeah, Judge Wanamaker, thank you for all you've done in this, and I don't have any interest in that. I want the big hammer out there for them to do this, and I don't want to make it easy to avoid this obligation. But I do think it's a little unfair if there really is no access to it. I'm not sure how to word that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's
through the chair, it's really difficult to. I understand what you're talking about, and it. It breaks my heart when people want to get in, get sobriety, and they can't get in. But the criminal law moves so fast, and there's a rule that cases have to be tried in 120 days or dismissed. And so if they don't get their opportunity to get in the therapeutic court, they'll pay their penalty by jail time, and it's hard to find a way around that. So I think the answer is to get, you know, the roadblocks to the operations of the felony court cured, and then the future people can get in.
Maybe I'll just work with Representative Roquebrook a little bit on how we might do that. But I'm not sure this amendment that we just drew up today really does it.
Okay, and we'd be glad to talk with you on that also.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
If I just could, for a moment, just comment. I appreciate the point that Representative Croft makes. There's always a concern I had in terms of availability, and I thought, frankly, if I was a defense attorney in Alaska doing this type of work, I'd be queuing my clients up into this program because it's a great program if they, you know, met the qualifications. And frankly, as Judge Wanamaker pointed out, the biggest problem we're having right now is with the state bureaucracy and supporting the program. And there's been some historic cultural resistance to this, particularly on the part of Department of Corrections, and to a lesser degree on the part of the prosecuting district attorneys, but at the state level. The municipality of Anchorage is what really took the bit by the horn a number of years ago to support Judge Wanamaker's program. But as we sit here today, it's unbelievable, notwithstanding the work that Representative Hocker did at the Corrections Department and the job owning I've tried to do, they were still having trouble with this. And I mean, those are right now. We've got to get this thing walking before we can run, and I'd be happy to work with Representative Croft any time in the future to look at that. But and we are expanding the program throughout the state, in large part with federal dollars that have just been made available. So that's an exciting prospect. But, and I'll be consulting with the Representative Hocker, the chairman of the Budget Subcommittee on Corrections, here if we can see if we can resolve this a little bit. Thank you, Chairman.
Follow on to Representative Roper's observation, and that was at his request this year, we did very easy transfers of funding and responsibility that hopefully will be moving us in the right direction on getting folks that are actually interested in this program in charge of running it, and hopefully we will resolve some of these issues.
Or, Mr. Chairman, next year we can move some of that money around so they get the message.
Great.
Or even before this year's over.
Okay. All right. You two, just a comment regarding Representative Croft's statement. I'm attracted to that somewhat, but I'm afraid it's such an overarching issue, whether it's not enough slots in a pioneer home or it's this person only has an hour off at lunch to get their DMV license, and every time they go there it's exactly 12, and they can only stay till punk the line is two persons too long for them to get their tag, and the utility applies for a permit for a air discharge two years before the deadline, and then finds it takes 3 years and they get it. So I join you on the issue, but I think if we did that, you'd have to pass out note paint a lot of other lessons.
Any other questions for Judge Wanamaker? Seeing none, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your hard work in this area, too.
Okay, thanks.
Wendy Hamilton, the Therapeutic Court the Coordinator here in Juneau, are you with us today, Wendy?
I am.
Oh, there you are. You're first. I thought you were on telecom. It's even better. Tell us who you are for the record. And
yes. Thank you for allowing me to speak today in favor of House Bill 136. My name is Wendy Hamilton. I'm the Juneau Therapeutic Court Coordinator. We in Juneau are in the planning process for a therapeutic court. It's going to be a felony and misdemeanor DWI court for drunken drivers. The three parts of this bill are would enhance the efficacy of our court. The first part of extending the incentives for a misdemeanor DWI to a felony DWI, that they're going to be entitled to have the same reduction in fine and sentence as in the misdemeanor court, since our court is going to be both felony and misdemeanor DWIs. The second part is another increase in incentives by allowing the reduction in fine to go from 50% to 75%. And then the third part is really needed to give part two some teeth, that you can't have a reduction in fine of 50 or 75% mean much if the mandatory minimum fine is not being charged on a regular basis in a DP court. So the passage of this bill would help not only the Juneau Therapeutic Court be most efficient and helpful, but also the Ketchikan and Bethel and Fairbanks Court when it gets running.
Does that conclude the testimony?
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions for you?
Thank you.
That's all I have on my list. Cindy, did you want to testify? We haven't heard from you yet. Okay. Is there anyone else online? Okay, no one else is here, no one else online. Any questions for the sponsor? Do you have a
Brooke for Quebec or Miss No Breaker?
Is that closer?
No,
she's my constituent, so she should know. Any questions at all for this sponsor? Okay, that's a good deal. Representing Broker, Representing Foster.
Sorry,
we got a minute. I don't know if anybody's here, but the Department of Law. No question on this one. Yeah, I'll sponsor come back up. We have an amendment here by Representative Croft, but we don't have Representative
Croft. He said he wanted to
talk.
That
was
Eddie. Yeah. You're good, George.
You guys are building rooms? Yeah. Well, the whole set aside now, showed up. Did you have a question on this one?
I just did on this one. I just have concerns, we don't know what the impact will be. We're not talking loud if I can. But it concerns me down here at the bottom, we want to talk to the law. It says the change created by this bill will have fiscal impact on the Department of Law because more trials will likely be required for those who can't afford the minimum budget. So I guess my real question would be, what have we done with these people now? We're just saying, well, you can't afford it, so we're not going to fine. And I guess it's frustrating to me that we can't figure out some other way to make these people pay for the grants.
Mr. Chairman, if I might. Mr. Chairman, I can appreciate your frustration. One of the reasons for the indeterminate in this one is that we're actually increasing fines. We're not increasing. We're asking the court to collect what we told them to collect, which will increase their revenue. However, there's also another provision of the bill that would slightly reduce funding. So the net effect here is actually increased revenue stream, I think. But their claim that there may be more trials as a result rather than plea bargains because of the higher fine, I find pretty disingenuous, and I'm not sure they can defend it. That's why it's indeterminate. And so, but I can appreciate that because they don't know what the true cash flow impacts are of doing this, you know, requiring the courts to do what we told them to do to begin with, and they haven't been doing it.
Just one other question. Do you know, has anybody talked about what the difference would be having more, is there a ballpark of 50, 100, 500 DUI offenses will go all over to the therapeutic court system? versus what constitutes the normal system now? Is there any kind of numbers that form about that or about talking about?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the issue in the therapeutic court model isn't the number of people that come in. The same number of people are in the system. It's the length of the time and the concentration of effort within the therapeutic court model that takes a little more effort and time. That's the number of people actually convicted doesn't change. Except, theoretically, and I think this is valid, the therapeutic court model will cut down recidivism and eventually stop the revolving door of alcohol and drug abuse. That's the idea. I think that this is one of the few models. What we've been able to do here is actually start turning this big lumbering ship of cultural problems that we have by doing some of these types of things. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
At the risk of sucking up, and I think you've already done everything you're doing for me this year. This is a problem that's just throwing people in jail isn't the only solution. It's just like in education, you want to deal with things that work and innovative ideas. So you've wrapped your head on this one. So I know you don't love coming up here every day, but I appreciate your efforts with sincerity.
Me too.
I see there's a judiciary committee under in the
Oh, way. That's right.
We'll
pass that to the best one to the bill. Yes. Any questions on the letter of intent?
Thank you, Representative Hopper, for
being here. Can you explain that? What's in record?
Self-explanatory, or you can consult with the chair of judiciary. That's okay.
Good news.
Just a point. I believe that Representative Croft indicated that if he intended to do anything with this management piece, he's going to take the cut out of the floor. I don't think he has got the other.
I think that's serious.
I don't know if he was.
No, he said that he wasn't.
He said no. He wasn't off.
Yeah.
Okay.
He said he worked with me, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
He's sucking up too.
Okay, let's get this bill out of here.
I have a 36 out of May. Was the attached letter to Kent, but the attached persona was the referendum.
Any objections?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
All right, let's take a brief edit here for the final bill. Southfield on 20th Street, and we have Josh Cassidy with us, representing the chairman of the Labor Conference Committee. And we do have some people here in the audience as well at the health conference to testify on this. Before we get to them, Mr. Graff will be in the Southfield Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Josh Appleby, staff representative Anderson. I'm here to present the House Bill 123. It's a board extension bill. What we've tried to do this year, Mr. Chairman, is instead of bringing through the entire committee process several individual board extension bills, we've tried to combine these into one bill. House Bill 123 extends the sunset for the boards of barbers and hairdressers, social work examiners, the Board of Pharmacy, the Board of Professional Counselors, psychologists, and psychological associate examiners, and veterinary examiners. Each of these boards have been recommended by the Division of Legislative Audit for extension. When it was in House Labor and Commerce, we adjusted the standard extension dates to meet the recommendations of Legislative Audit. We extended the barbers and hairdressers to 2011, social work examiners, pharmacy, professional counselors, and psychologists to 2010, and veterinary examiners to 2009. I see in the audience we have Pat Davidson from Legislative Audit, who's here to answer any specific questions from the audits as far as their recommendations or their findings. Also, House Bill 123 has sections 1 through 4 and section 11 dealing with fines and penalties collected by the Division of Occupational Licensing. The Director Rick Urian is here to explain. He brought those amendments to us, and he'd be happy to get into detail what those sections involve with. But other than that, it's a pretty straightforward extension bill, and that's what we have.
Okay, very good. Any questions?
Just, Mr. Chairman, one thing that will help you in the context of this whole thing. Is Mr. Appleby now, has he ever been involved in the legislative skits?
Okay, any other questions?
On that note, has Mr. Appleby ever been involved in selling ladies' hugs?
okay, that's a different bill. I didn't really
I just wondered why is he needing to change right now? I think we've always done all these boards and commissions, which frankly I think there's too many, but we've done them one at a time. It allows us to look for one lobby at a time, that's one specific set of questions at a time. We limit the lobbyists to one issue rather than multiple. Maybe there's good reasons for one to go forward and good reasons for one not to go forward. And by lumping these together, what really legislative efficiency or public policy benefit do we get than what we have now?
Well, through the chair, Representative Weirach, having gone through this process, bringing it certainly this far, I believe that this experiment might prove itself to be not worth it in the end. We were hoping to find that by combining these boards into one bill and dealing with them all at the same time, we would find that it was more efficient. And so far, I'm unhappy to report that it doesn't seem to be that way, but we're certainly trying and moving forward. Mr. Chairman, Representative Stoltz, we put the boards together and moved it through House Labor and Commerce, and then it comes to this committee, and the conversions, as Representative Barak mentioned, of lobbyists and separate interest pulling the bill in different directions, we kind of created something more than we thought we were getting into. We selected six boards that were all recommended for extension, all good boards with positive outlooks, and we thought it would be quite clean. And so we're going through that process, and we're we're working with the different punches as they come, and we're hoping that you know, once we get things back on track, that we'll continue to move forward.
No, Mr. Chairman, I was following the Representative Weirach's inquiry. I think there's enough temptation on the sunset extensions to load it up with special interests. And if you have five or six on there, it's a lot easier to carry chattel because you've got five maybe very non-controversial must-pass, you know, sub-constituencies, and you start to get a constant, very controversial, contentious last-minute amendment added at any one of the committees or on the floor. You have five non-contentious boards tell you please pass the bill. And you've got a built-in lobby, five or six groups, and all their constituency to carry a piece of crud or a whip. It happens enough on single subject sunsets. So, you know, with all due respect to the chairman, and I know it's good to try different things, I guess, but we care about my observations in the most constructive manner I present them.
Okay, very good. I think other questions for Mr. Appleby. Let's go ahead. Rick, do you want to testify, or do you have questions? Or
better testify.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Urien. I'm the director of the Division of Occupational Licensing. You have to forgive me, I'm a little bit under the weather, so I see if I can't get through this. I can't sign my name. I'm here to explain sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 11, which is a major part of this bill before you. Those of you that sat on this committee last year, you know, I was here and tried the same amendments and was unable to do that. So what this, as you know, a law requires us to, whatever it costs us to regulate a profession is what what we charge for fees. We essentially take all the total cost, divide by the number of licensees, and that's basically the license cost. For years, included in the fees was fines. A lot of any fines that were generated went into that mix. And then somebody in their wisdom read the law, and the law says, doesn't address the issue of fines, it only says fees. So this, before you, allows us to take whatever fines we generate from disciplinary actions and put that into the mix for establishing the fee paid by licensees. And I have to understand that this is not, I know last year it was said it may be a conflict of interest or an ethical problem, but all the boards would go out and fine all these people and they would pay for their fees that way, but that's not the way it operates. And the cost of generating a fine far exceeds the amount of the fine that you collect, so it's a losing operation. And this is it's a matter of fairness, because a good bit of the costs that go into each profession, a good bit of that cost in many cases is disciplinary actions. So you would, if that's what the professionals are paying for, paying for the disciplinary action, the least they could do is have some of those costs offset by whatever fines were collected. Also, the law says that we charge, we regulate by profession. And this we want to regulate by at the board level. For instance, if there was a case against a physician's assistant, under existing law, whatever that cost would be borne only by a physician's assistant. The amendments we had before you would put that into all those licenses under in the medical profession under 0864. Doctors and osteopaths and everybody else would share in those fines. So and give us a broader base to spread the expenses. So I can tell you that absolutely every licensed profession that we have supports these amendments. And I hope that you will pass them.
Thank you, Mr. Urien. Thanks for your efforts. For example, in barbers, hairdressers, anesthetists, tattoo artists, whatever, I mean, the whole group,
I don't know any tattoo artists, but I probably know dozens of barbers and hairdressers, and they've had a lot of complaints about the tattoo artists, body piercers, and on their board. And is this, and some of the complaints were relative that they have bear more of the costs of that smaller group. Would this proposed amendment allow that cost to be more proportionally assessed to those that are actually causing the costs?
That's actually, we spread that out among all those members of that in that board. All of those would share. Yes.
No, I'm just chewing on that one. I know this is an imperfect process.
Yes.
But that's probably one of the biggest complaints I've heard is about that. But it looks like it or not, I get my hair cut professionally. Fairly often, because I keep it short, and that sort of makes it, it's mentioned to me at least a couple times a year.
Yeah,
I'll just continue
to grumble
about it, I guess.
Yes, frankly, I can't think of any big cases that we've had in that particular board at all. Frankly, we have not very much action put on there.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Thank you, Rick. Any other questions for Rick while we're up there? Same on, I guess we'll call it teleconference. On teleconference, we have Barry Christensen with the Alaska Pharmacy Association.
Yeah, hi. This is Barry Christensen of the Alaska Pharmacists Association. I guess I would ask, this may or may not be appropriate, but I would ask Representative Wyrock if he has an amendment he would like to introduce.
He does, but we're not at that point yet, Barry.
Then I'd like to go ahead and just stay in line and share my comments for that time, if that's all right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll move to Robert Lane with the Alaska Psychiatric Association.
That's actually the Alaska Psychological Association.
Mine says Patrick, but anyway, I'll trust you on that one.
It's our board is one of the ones that's in this bill, and I come before the committee today to speak in favor of the bill. The HB 123 extends our board of psychologists and psychological associate examiners to 2010, consistent with the legislative audit. It was a clean audit, and we feel like that part should be a fairly simple kind of thing, and certainly endorse this bill. At the risk of being a little bit of a thorn in the side of the committee, we did want to suggest that the committee look at amendment language that would allow a small technical change in our licensing laws that would permit our board to be able to write regulations that keep our state consistent with reciprocal license agreements that are happening around the nation and in Canada. If I understand correctly, I believe the committee has had language passed out, and if I understood the last speaker correctly and the chair, then those will be taken up at another point. But I just wanted to mention ahead of time that we are in favor of that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lane. Next, we have Cindy Bueller. I believe she's the chair of the State Board of Pharmacy.
Yes, my name is Cindy Bueller, and I'm currently chair of the Alaska State Board of Pharmacy. And I just wanted to lend my support to House Bill 123. I don't have a lot of particulars to say about it. But I just wanted to call in and voice my support for this.
Thank you. And seeing no one else online, if Barry, if you and Robert and Cindy, I guess you also, if you would have comments later regarding amendments, if you'll stay online, we will get back to you at the appropriate time. So is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify on House Bill 123 at this time? Pat, please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pat Davidson with the Division of Legislative Audit. I would appreciate being the opportunity to provide a very brief synopsis of the audits conducted under these boards. To let you know, 12 boards and commissions are under sunset this year. Typically, there's only, you know, 4 to 6. So you are dealing with quite a number of boards and commissions this year that you don't typically see. And as a result of that, many of our recommendations for extensions, we looked at a 4 to 6 year window for these recommendations to try to smooth things out a little bit. The Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, we did recommend that it be extended to June 30, 2011. We looked at the licensing fees and found that they were increased in 2001 to cover a growing deficit with that board. And it does appear now that that increase is sufficient to keep the board moving along financially. We also, in that report, made a statutory recommendation for a statutory change, and that would allow the board to delegate the administration of the state's practical exam to the training schools or the apprentices' supervisors. While this process could be spot-checked by the board, it would not have the independence of a board-administered test. However, it would be less expensive for those apprentices, and we do not believe it would expose the public to a substantial increase in risk. Board of Social Work Examiners, we recommended a 5-year extension on this one. As a matter of fact, for the 4 behavioral health boards that are under sunset this year, that being the Psychological Board of Psychology and Psychological Associates, Social Workers, Board of Marital and Family Therapy, and the Board of Professional Counselors, we did examine whether it would be prudent to combine those boards into one mega behavioral health board. We came down with the recommendation that the Board of Professional Counselors and Marital and Family could be combined. And if they were going to be combined, we recommended a 4-year extension. Since this bill takes the Board of Professional Counselors singularly, we do support the 5-year recommendation. Board of Pharmacy, we recommended a 5-year extension, which is in the bill. There were 2 recommendations in the report, both to the division and to the board for some improvements. Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associates, we did recommend a 5-year extension for the board. We further recommended fees be increased to eliminate the growing deficit, or to eliminate the deficit, and that the Office of the Governor make timely appointments to that board. And then finally, for veterinary examiners, we did make a recommendation for a 4-year extension and also made a recommendation to the board that the content and the timeliness of its annual reports be improved.
Any questions for that?
So the fees section 11, the department testified on that first one, Bill, could you give us your
The comments, I guess, that I would have on that section, in general, from a bean counter's point of view, by adding in fines and penalties into this equation, you're going to be taking money that was originally general fund money and moving it into a program receipt. And so, again, to a bean counter's way, you're giving them a general fund supplemental into that budget process. And the fines and the penalties vary. I took a look on the accounting system. In fiscal year 03, it appears that it was that the division collected about $81,000 worth of fines and penalties. In fiscal year 2004, it was around $102,000. And then so far in 05, it's about $54,000. And Mr. Urien did raise a question about whether or not there's any conflicts with the boards imposing those fines and then those fines being calculated into the license fees. it's a matter of materiality whether that's ever going to occur. The fines under the centralized licensing, fines are capped at $5,000. However, when you go into the individual boards, they do vary widely. For example, the accountants, their maximum fine is $500. You go to the dentist, it's $25,000. Architects, engineers, land surveyors, $10,000. So it's that interplay between the number of licensees and the maximum amount of fines, whether you would ever get to that position, whether or not you would say it's sufficiently material that it would run up against the Executive Branch Ethics Act, because there is a direct connection between those two.
Any other questions on staff?
I'm just wondering what the downside is. If it's going to take GF, put it as a program, see how does that affect aspect of what we do? Any negative light?
Through the chairman, Representative Wyrack, there would be just less general fund monies for you to appropriate.
Thank you, Pat. If there's no one else that wishes to testify, we'll close public testimony and bring 123 back before the committee. I believe there's two amendments. I'm not sure who's offering amendment
one, but
amendment
number one.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'd invite Mr. Walsh up.
Please come home.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Walsh, and I'm registered to lobby for the Alaska Psychological Association. Dr. Lane is on standby, or still online, up in Anchorage. Amendment number one expands the Alaska statute 0886150, the licensing by credentials. It allows for an additional reference by credential to, besides the current American Board of Professional Psychology, to include now that or certified or registered with a credentialing organization in psychology approved by the board in regulation and with requirements essentially similar to or higher than the current licensure requirements. So evidently, and Dr. Lane can speak to this, evidently there are now, since this statute was last addressed, other credentialing organizations that are equally credible, if you will, or professional in nature, and psychologists may have those in their portfolio as they come north and petition to be credentialed or licensed by credential. So to the extent that that's accurate, that's my understanding of the amendment.
Mr. Lane, would you like to make any comments on this?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Essentially, there's two organizations, the Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards and the National Health Register, that are now able with databases to keep track of people's credentials and allow a formal declaration or certificate issued to the person that would be able to travel with them from state to state and facilitate licensing. Currently, there's 26 states, 32 states and provinces altogether, but 26 states that have passed legislation that allow this to happen, and there's another 18 more that are working on it. So largely what this does is keep Alaska's laws, or allow Alaska's Board of Psychology and Psychological Associate Examiners to be able to craft regulations that keep us consistent with national trends and reciprocity.
All right, thank you, Mr. Lane. Are there any questions of Mr. Lane? Seeing none, once again, thank you. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
We have Amendment 1 before us. I will remove my objection.
Is this department?
Mr. Urey, you have a comment?
Oh. I don't see Mark in here, I think he's left. So I'll remove my objection with Representative Wyra.
I don't have any, I'm not going to object to this, I just wondered if we can see if you got a comment.
Well, I don't know if the chairman's intent was to move this or not, but I think there's probably a couple of questions that still need to be answered. We're probably going to take it up tomorrow. I believe our next meeting is going to be on Monday, or on Saturday. But it'll be on HB 130, so we'll probably take it up on, we'll take it up again on Monday. But John, if you'd like to come forward.
Through the chair, Representative Reinwerk, the board would still be required to adopt regulation. So I don't know if that's probably that's where the jurisdiction lies. I don't know if it's at the director level.
All I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, is it does put a requirement for the board to adopt our regulation. That's I understand your point.
Okay. And I have not heard any objection from the director.
Thank you. If there's no objections, we will go ahead and accept Amendment 1. And we may discuss that if we decide to keep the bill for partial. So I'm seeing no objections. We'll approve the Amendment 1.
Well, John.
Next, we'll move on to Amendment 2.
Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment 2.
Yeah. There's an objection.
I object.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative
Myra. Yeah, I think some folks online that want to testify to this, Mr. Chairman, if you go ahead.
There
are some folks here that want to testify online, present.
Okay. Who's here would like to testify to Amendment 2?
And Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and I'm also a registered lobbyist for the Alaska Association of Pharmacists, and the legislative chair, Barry Christensen, is online, and also, as you heard earlier, also the chair to the Board of Pharmacy is also online to speak to this amendment.
Great. Thank you. There's nobody else here with Mr. Christensen?
As they're testifying, I guess since we're the finance committee, wanting to address possible fiscal impacts, I assume one of the results of becoming a care provider, there's some Medicaid eligibility and how that's going to impact the HESS budget. As what the hopes of those wanting to regain this enhanced license, and what they think they'll be able to be eligible for.
I think you have some of the same questions I have, Representative Stoltz. So we will move to Mr. Christensen, and listen to your testimony on Amendment number 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Barry Christensen. I'm a community pharmacist in Ketchikan. I'm also a chair of the Legislative Committee for the Alaska Pharmacists Association. The association is a professional association of licensed pharmacists and technicians in the state of Alaska. The association appreciates the support of Representatives Anderson and Wyrock on the amendment you have before you. This amendment to the Pharmacy Practice Act is a simple one and recognizes pharmacists as health care providers of the state of Alaska. This is important to our membership for two primary reasons. First, in billing. In 2003, Congress passed something called the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, and that includes a provision for something called medication therapy management, which is basically an idea that says that someone should look at and see if patients are receiving the correct medication therapy. And so in terms of pharmacists, that would be paying pharmacists to look at therapy instead of just dispensing prescriptions, basically. Now, this is Medicare, mind you, not Medicaid. Our fear is that when this occurs in 2006 is that the insurance companies that are contracted with Medicare will require that pharmacists be recognized in the state they practice in as healthcare providers. Secondly, with billing, currently we have a problem in Alaska where workman's comp doesn't recognize pharmacists as healthcare providers. This has been a problem for our members and our pharmacies because we don't get notices when claims are controverted. That is when the claim has been denied because it's not valid, then our folks are caught holding the bag, and it's been said that we don't have to be told that the claim was controverted because we're not recognized by statute as healthcare providers. Secondly, we'd like to be recognized for what we are, and that's healthcare providers. This amendment will not change the current scope of our practice, but merely recognize us as providers on the healthcare team. Real briefly, I hear the concerns from the chair and others about the Medicaid, and we did discuss with the HES folks, and they did not object. They don't see where this will increase the fiscal responsibility to pharmacists. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Any questions? Barry, and I don't know if many of you can answer it. I do have a question because that was one of my concerns is that by allowing pharmacists to bill insurance companies, what impacts are going to have not only on health insurance but Medicaid and so on. And basically what you're telling me is that's exactly what this does is this will allow pharmacists to bill health care providers for services rendered.
Well, it's not specifically. That's not exactly what this bill specifically does. At least that's not our intention per se. But we just would like to be recognized, and in areas where we're allowed to do so, that yes, we'd be allowed to do that. But specifically, we're not looking for language that says that insurance companies or Medicaid or anybody else has to pay us. We just want to be recognized as a healthcare provider. So if they offer it to us, then yes, we can, because we feel like in instances we can actually save the system money.
Right, and I'm not denying that you don't do a service to the community or a service to the people who use your pharmacies and so on, because I understand the medication issue and looking at the conflicting drugs that doctors may prescribe, and your job is to try to keep any of those reactions from happening. And I understand that my I guess not really so much a problem with it is just simply that we're looking at adding an amendment to this bill that really changes it in my mind. It could conceivably be a rather large fiscal note attached to this thing that we're not aware of and don't have our hands wrapped around by a simple amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stoltz.
I know this isn't the HES committee, but I just, the possibility of, I guess looking at the possibility of questions, is this going to open the door for pharmacists to prescribe or to alter prescriptions, or there are certainly some controversial drugs out there that are in statuses. I'll just throw a contentious issue. RU 486, which is a national debate right now, throw that into the mix, and I have a lot of respect for pharmacy, though. I'm no original customer, and I've gotten to know anything else. I'd sure like to get some of these questions addressed.
Mr. Christian, do you have any comments?
Yes, I would. Representative Stoltz, through the chair, actually, this bill does not expand the scope of practice for pharmacists. Basically, it's pretty much a one-liner that in our Pharmacy Practice Act that just recognizes us as healthcare providers. It doesn't do anything to our scope of practice. It doesn't change anything that we're doing now. If that answers your question.
Representative Stoltz.
Mr. Chairman, a lot of boards and commissions and other professions have litigated, you know, taken what appears to be a simple issue and have expanded it through the courts and wear down a ability of members wanting to fight. This was just a conceptual amendment about a half hour before committee started, and as a major policy issue, and I guess that makes my whole conversation relevant about having all these bills all thrown together, five or six boards, and then a major policy issue thrown onto a simple sunset. It sure creates an awkwardness for me.
Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and again, I want all the members here to, you know, understand that we have been talking to different legislators all session, and that, again, our intent was under the statutes in which you were extending for the boards, that there is a definition in which we were hoping to just add the provider status language. It's not something that's unusual. This year, you have already passed House Bill 95 that passed the body this week regarding the public health. In that piece of legislation, you have a definition of healthcare provider. In that, on basically page 20, line 23, healthcare providers, and within that means any person that provides healthcare services. Healthcare providers include hospital, medical office, special care facilities, physicians, psychiatrists, pharmacists, dentists, and on. Also, in another piece of legislation this year, which is the other chairs, Representative Myers' Bill 85, allowing young people to be able to carry their aspirators in schools, was also in that section, means licensed physicians, healthcare providers, or licensed physicians, nurses, physician assistant, village health aides, and pharmacists. All they're trying to do is get in their enabling statutes what they're already doing. There was not ever meant to have expanding any practice or any service that they're already doing. This has already started taking place across the whole nation. More than 12 states have already amended their Pharmacist Practice Acts to add in healthcare provider status. Whether or not the existing language before you is the best, we were wishing that we could maybe amended this earlier, but this was our opportunity that was brought forward for us to do this, and we of course appreciate that Representative Ryrock today was at least willing to put it forward so we could have the dialogue. So it's not anything that's not already happening. It does and will have to happen in this state, and this was the time that we felt was most appropriate to do it, and of course would really appreciate your support. As I stated, if we need to work with the drafters on better language, the original draft that we gave the drafter basically just under our practice, added just a few words, and of course the drafter came back with a much longer version to that. If there's any questions.
It doesn't change the scope of practice, which to me makes it, I understand Representative Stoltz's point about major policy questions, but if we were going to change the things they could do within the healthcare field, that would be one thing. Simply recognizing that their healthcare provider doesn't, to me, involve the same kind of policy choices. Nurses can't prescribe, but they are healthcare providers.
Thank you, Representative Crowder. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am going to not support this. I am not going to support this amendment this time. It is a sweeping amendment. And you have a line here that makes this effective to all instances in the past statutes. That's pretty sweet. We had no testimony from only one side of the debate advocating for it. We had not had direct testimony from the Department of Health and Social Services where the health care provider is a very specific term in many instances. I do not know what a fiscal note and what fiscal analysis is. I don't know what the government about Medicaid, any Medicaid issues in the state. If this is where we're going to go. This is the type of clutter that we didn't have to have for the 3 years I've served on this committee to avoid having here in boardroom. We have to make these simply a decision on should the board continue or not. And even with the other one, which is already in this bill, I would say this bill is perilously close to something that goes on general principles on the board. So, particularly here, we've got such a policy call, I would really clutter this issue on that purpose. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments on amendment number two?
Representative Kelly, I just wonder, Mr. Chairman, if the sort of mechanical fact, should this amendment pass, is that a pharmacist can sign off on Medicare form, that if we're limited to that for purposes of that, they shall be considered, or something like that. That might narrow it more. The other thing is perhaps that somebody from the Department of Law could actually confirm that this is nothing more than changing dog catcher to canine
control officer.
So I'm just trying to figure out if they're trying to accomplish the ability to move Medicare payments more quickly, we might narrow enough so we can accomplish that specifically. Just a suggestion.
Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Robinson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and under the definition of pharmacist in the Act, it says, pharmacist means an individual currently licensed by this state to engage in the practice of pharmacy. And again, for all of the members to understand what we were hoping from the amendment, that there would just be an additional wording that would say, and who is thereby recognized as a health care provider by the state. Unfortunately, when the amendment arrived, it was obviously much more intense than what we had originally asked for or had seen. So our language was few words, just basically amending our definition that's in our statute, and was not to go as far as this amendment has taken place. We, too, don't quite know how reaching this amendment is, but I just want all the members to understand that that was our intent, and it was just to expand the definition of pharmacy within our own practice.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative
Barber. I appreciate that, Robinson. I would like to deal with this dialogue and some of the general concerns related to this kind of language, so you have it at least you have an opportunity to address them maybe in a different kind of amendment at a later stage of business bill pursuit. The system. This was taken by legislative legal for the way they thought it was intended, or the way they could draft it.
So amendment number two is withdrawn. Accept is amendment one. Are there any other questions or concerns about 1.2? Seeing none, Representative Foster.
Yes, sir. I'll move out here for
1.2. Just a question. I saw the third room when I was bunking or something. We had this concern about pulling all these boards together, and then we wandered away from it. Did we ever, is everybody happy?
I thought, Mr. Chairman, you wanted to hold this one to a
there's enough concern about it. I think that we will take it up. Hold 123 over until some of the questions that some of the members have could be answered. So we will hold 123 until we'll probably schedule it on Friday. And that's the last issue to come up before the committee today. Next meeting, finance will be canceled for tomorrow. and the next meeting will be Saturday at 11 a.m. from 1 p.m. The committee will be taking up House Bill 123, the University Lands Research, 130, excuse me. Saturday, 11 o'clock, Bill 1. The committee will be taking up House Bill 130, which is the University Lands Research Force for If there's no other business to come before the committee is adjourned.
Saturday, University Labs.
Yes.